Thank you for listening to The Treasure Hunt, my personal attempt to share my musical curiosity with you. My name is Bas Wiegers, and I'm a conductor. Today, I want to investigate how close the relationship is between the score and the way to get to a sounding result. Or, to stay with the treasure metaphor, between the map and the journey to find the actual gold. One of the big mysteries surrounding conductors is the mystery of interpretation. Interpretation is defined by dictionaries as a representation of something done in a certain style. So apparently, in this score, there is room to interpret the signs in different ways. Now, contrary to Herbert von Karajan, who could not give Beethoven a call to discuss Ludwig's weird metronome marks and what he meant with them, I can actually email or app or call some living composers to check these questions that I have about the score. I also do this very often, sometimes long before the first rehearsal, especially when I do not know a composer yet, and I might not know in what kind of style I need to see this piece. But what does a living composer himself have to say about the concept of interpretation? Who better to talk to than to Georg Friedrich Haas? We have worked together many times in the past, and he's now also present at our rehearsals for his new opera Sycorax. Let's go to the theater and find out what he thinks. Hello, Georg. So we are now in the theater. We might hear some background noises here and there. We are in the Witmerhall in Bern, and I'm very happy that you're joining me here for today's podcast. Now, maybe it's a little bit weird because I have such a famous composer here, but I don't really want to talk directly about your music. But I want to talk about our relationship, and not you and me, but the relationship between the composer and the conductor, or the composer and the musician, maybe. If I may, because there is this weird space between what you write down, which you know, we could call this a treasure map, or you know, a sort of way to find the music, and then what we musicians have to make of it. How would you define this space between what you write and what we do?
Well, so first of all, I want to tell you that I'm really happy that we work together in this podcast. And I'm even more happy, please forgive me, that we work together in the performance of the opera, which is really wonderful and beautiful, and it's a great experience.
Same for me. I'm happy to be here with you.
And I don't agree when you say, let's talk about the relationship between conductor and composer, because each composer is different, and I don't know this so very much because, well, my students, but much more important, each conductor is different, and there exists, let's say, a general division between, let's say, conductors who seriously try to understand what is happening in the music, and other conductors who just try to survive in the best way as possible for the orchestra. And I would start with a beautiful parallel which Swiss composer Helena Winkelmann told me when we met. Well, she's also a great violinist, and she played the solo in my double concerto for violin and contraforte. And she said, well, sometimes it is as if you are sitting on a car on the side seat. The car is driving with 150 kilometers an hour on the highway, and you recognize the driver is drunk. This is the feeling which you have sometimes when a conductor is working about your piece, and the only hope which you have is, I hope I can get safe out of this car and say. And I think this is, and when you call this the score treasure map, I would say the biggest treasure is for a composer to find conductors who really try to understand what is in this music and communicate this with the performers. And so when you compare with treasure maps, it's quite good. I personally prefer to compare it with a recipe for cooking.
Yeah. I was going to say that, actually. It's sometimes a cookbook.
And just to bring an example, but and also a cookbook is not able to really notate how much pepper you shall have to use. Yeah?
And it depends on the pepper also, because some peppers are stronger than others.
Exactly, yes.
I'm wondering, because you're avoiding a little bit I like your definition, but you're avoiding we're walking around it for now. But what is always really hard from a conductor's point of view or from a musician's point of view is that you don't know the bandwidth that you have, and the question is always how much should I do of what is written, and maybe how much space is there besides what is written. Let me, in your music, you write a lot of quarter equals 60 in a 4/4 bar, and now I know that this quarter equals 60 can also sometimes be 66, or it can also sometimes be 52. And for you is more important the flow of the music, or you know, the direction of the music, or and not so much the trueness to this metronome mark. Right. But how do we find this out? I mean, I know it because we've worked together, but how do we know from getting a score?
I believe in many times this is just self-explaining. And it also depends sometimes from the acoustic situation. If there's more reverb, you have to go slower. And this is you give the space for the plant to grow. And if you see the plant works well, then you have the right tempo.
This is very beautiful. I forget which conductor that was. I think it was Selby Daka asking it to somebody else, one of his teachers, and he noticed that this teacher would always do slightly different tempo, and then Selby Daka asked him, "Why? How do you know the tempo?" And then the conductor said, "When I hear it."
Yes,
it's very silly, but it's also very true.
Yeah.
Can we go, because you said you were teaching as well. Mm-hmm. So, of course, when it's your own music and when it's a conductor you know or you've worked together with, then I can imagine that this works. But how do you talk to your pupils when you want to explain them how to make something clear? I mean, how much clarity do you try to inspire them to put in the score?
The first question always must be, what is it really what you want to do?
Hmm.
And I've seen many situations, beginners of composition, they don't really write what they hear, they write what they are able to notate. And when we work, this is maybe the most important question, and it's even more important since we have the computer programs of notation, where you can write things which look very clever and don't make any musical sense. And when you also see the techniques with copy-paste, transposing, all this, where you can get even elementary variations automatically.
Yeah.
And then talk, how can you avoid to be influenced by these possibilities?
Yeah.
And it's not only a critique against the computer, against the programs, because also when you write music with hand, you make compromises.
That's what I was. That was my next question. Yeah. Because you already make a translation from what you dream of in your head, or mm-hmm. what is maybe you know a vision, an auditive vision that you have, to something that you have to put down on paper, which is definitely you know less little bit less beautiful than what you imagined.
Yeah, well, I compare it with Lego. You have the notation is like building a house, and yeah. Lego, where you have either 8 points or 6 points on a brick.
Yeah, right,
and the circles have all the same radius and these things. So it's, my personal technique is when I compose, I use the notation at the very last moment. My notebooks where I compose are just normal paper without the five lines.
Okay.
Because the five lines are horrible.
Yeah.
The five lines suggest the tonal system of seven pictures with different different intervals in per octave. And also I have a C or I have a C sharp, but all these possibilities between is much more easy to notate an abstract way.
Also, but I mean, even when you look at a Mozart sonata, if you would play what is written, then you would hear ta da di da ta 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 di, which no living soul would ever play.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
even there, you know, phrasing or slight variations in tempo were, of course, also a limitation to a lot of composers in the past.
Yeah.
I think what happened in the past is often that the people who were writing the notes were so directly connected to the people who were playing the notes that there was, you know, if Mozart wrote something and his musicians in Vienna would play it, they would know more or less how to play this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is something that is gotten lost somewhere during the 20th century, where we don't have this connection, direct connection to composers and performers.
But the first thing it's very good, is that very useful that you have to learn how to play Mozart, because a lot of music teachers are living from this job, to explain it. Or on the other way, the music of the past you only can perform if you are part of the oral tradition. And in new music, and this is an important thing, this oral tradition more and more disappears because there is no time to develop it.
Mm-hmm.
If I write an orchestra piece, there are three rehearsals. And within these three rehearsals, I don't even get so far as you got when you sang Mozart sonata. Because there's no chance to develop a musical language. In smaller orchestras, like for example here in Bern, where you work with amazing singers and with an orchestra which is very passionate, this is, of course you can do this. Maybe there's something similar to the tradition in the past. When Mozart composed for a pianist, he knew what this pianist will be able to play.
Absolutely.
And so do I.
Yeah. No, but what I sense also is that we're getting to a time now where composers want to give this space also to the musicians.
Mm-hmm.
And they need this kind of dedication to do the last, say, 5 or 10% of this piece, which was a completely normal behavior from everything before, let's say, late Beethoven, or even in Beethoven, you know, everything before Stravinsky, basically, there was always this connection between who was writing the music and who was playing it. In the Baroque, of course, there were all these ornaments that nobody bothered to write down because they knew that, you know, when Corelli wrote something for this or this violinist, he would be able to play it in the way that Corelli wanted it to be played. And it's nice to see that composers find this space back. So I'm writing mm-hmm. something, it's not completely finished, maybe, and you can figure out the last 5 or 10% because I trust you
mm-hmm.
as a
mm-hmm.
musician or as a whatever. To find the style. And of course, with an orchestra rehearsal, with an orchestra piece that you only get 3 rehearsals for, you can't do that as a composer because we don't have the time to do that. So that is then you have to be more pragmatic somehow, which is also interesting in a very different way. But yeah, it's much nicer if you can try out things and find find a real Ausführungspraxis. What is that in English? A practice of playing.
I think as a real problematic development happened at the beginning of the 20th century. Because until this time, there was one language of music. There were sometimes fights, which direction shall it go? For example, Wagnerianism and Bruckner. But it's only one language.
I'm not sure, is that true? Because there was a very different language in France in the 17th century than in Italy in the 17th century or in Spain.
But the difference between the French Baroque music and the Spanish Baroque music is a little bit smaller than the difference between Richard Strauss and Stravinsky.
Maybe, yeah.
And this fundamental different changes. And I believe the real important new thing what Schoenberg brought into the music history consciously is that you have to decide which language do you want to speak.
Yeah.
But this also means that there is not one generalized way how to speak it. Of course, when you study traditional music, old music, Aufführungspraxis, the praxis of the reality of performances. You learn the French way, the English way, but we don't even know how to play Alban Berg and Webern correctly. There's all the performance praxis is dead, and we are starting. It's a notation, and I believe many composers, I would include myself in this, I try to find an approximation to this what I want in notation. Yeah. And the really difficult problem is, where are variabilities possible?
Exactly. Yeah. That's always what I struggle with as a conductor. You read a score, and then in this case, I know you, so how I start to read the score is already different, mm-hmm. because I know what you're looking for, or most of the time, and otherwise I can give you a call. But if you don't know somebody, and if it's the first time you play somebody's music, then it's really hard to define, and you have to sort of try to figure out, okay, now he or she wrote five times sforzandissimo, so I suppose that, you know, this is an element that is important in mm-hmm. his, her, their score.
Mm-hmm.
And this search is something that I think a lot of musicians are really struggling with, but like this is really our daily practice. Mm-hmm. How much space is there? Mm-hmm. Does it make a difference? I'm going to say yes, but does it make a difference when you write somebody a piece for somebody that you really know? Like, I know you're writing now a clarinet piece for Bernhard Zachhuber.
Yeah.
He's somebody that you've worked with already for 20 years or mm-hmm. longer.
Mm-hmm.
Do you write differently?
Yes, absolutely. Because in my opinion, the communication partner of the composer is never the audience. It's always the performer.
Hmm.
And the performer's communications partner is on one side the composer, of course, but on the other side the audience.
Hmm.
And if the performer believes in the music, and then everything is fine. And if for example, the last first performance, which just happened a week ago, was a piece for four Austrian brass bands. And they played my music in their traditional clothes in the park of a castle which was owned by the Duke of Metternich. It is really everything historical and a kind of problematic background. But what I tried to communicate with them is a ritual of freedom. And it was fascinating just to what discuss with them. There was one example where maybe this is a good demonstrative example for freedom and how have you to do what the composer has written. For me it was important that these brass bands are cut into individuals.
Yeah.
And broken into individuals.
Yeah.
And there's one part where they have to leave the group. Each performer themselves, and in the score is written, do 14 steps, then play fortissimo in F sharp, then do 23 steps, play fortissimo B flat, and so on. Yeah. There's nobody who can prove if 200 persons of a brass ensemble really walk 20, and if they really walk this, and they may change it, and the music will not be disturbed. But what would be wrong is if they would not celebrate it.
Yeah.
And I had a discussion with one performer. I said to him, please, sorry, you must go more consciously in the steps. Yeah. And she said to me, oh, you think like military.
No.
And I said, yes.
Oh, yes.
Yes, like military. But this military has only one soldier, and this is you.
Yeah.
And this is...
I mean, this is something that you do very often in your music. Yeah. You give liberty to people, but in such a way that you sort of force them to explore this liberty.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in Coma, the other opera that I did, you force the orchestra to play half the piece in complete darkness. And by doing so, you... of course, they can't read notes, they can't see a conductor, so nobody can conduct them. So you force them to listen to each other. If they don't, the whole thing collapses immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And in one hand, it gives them very much freedom to to interpret for themselves. So it could be like maybe 30 seconds longer or 30 seconds shorter. That's all fine. But in the other hand, you give them an immense responsibility that is taken out of the hands of the conductor, which is very healthy because mm-hmm. we're always seen as this kind of half god that has to tell when everything is happening. And when they feel this responsibility, they can also start to enjoy it. And I think that's something very interesting. And it's a very different part of interpretation, which doesn't mean to play the right notes at the right moment, but to understand what you're doing and to stand behind it.
Yeah.
And this is very interesting. We had actually something similar here last week, where I'm giving cues to the orchestra, and they are sort of free to come in and out with guirlandes of harmonics, so to say. And then one of the viola players, lovely guy, he was asking me, like, are these helping notes or should I play them? And I said, no, you should play them.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, you know, I haven't done so until now, and you haven't said anything to me, you know, it mm-hmm. hasn't. And I said, you know, I have a lot to do, and actually the complete sound, you know, is anyway very beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have something to add to it, that would be wonderful. And it sort of gives another, it's not to me to tell him, okay, sorry, sir, you didn't play and it's your turn. No, it's up to you as a player to feel invited to do this.
Yeah.
And if you don't, then you don't play. It's also fine. It's not the end of the world.
I think these flexibilities are part of the composition.
Yeah.
When I composed, for example, I go back to this example for the brass band, when I composed these different numbers of steps and the pitches, I knew they will not do it.
Yeah.
But if I would write, go as many steps as you like and play whichever pitch you want to play, then I would get something completely different.
Yeah, then it would sound like an uninterested cacophony.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. And this is, when I started composing, I thought, okay, well, when I write something, I must be able to check it, I have to prove it, I have to control it. And then I very soon learned that I'm only a human being. I cannot hear more than four different lines, but 17 different lines is beautiful.
Yeah.
And do I not allow myself to compose because I cannot control it?
Yeah.
And then I very soon I decided, okay, I write things which I know nobody can control. And also this is a conductor. In this case, this one musician played something completely wrong. It still worked fine. okay, this happens, as long as this completely wrong thing is within the language.
Yeah.
And I would compare and say, okay, if I play C sharp or C in a Beethoven symphony, everybody hears it. That's true. But in a C major chord of Beethoven, if you change the E and the G, I'm not sure if everybody hears
it. Yeah, absolutely.
Because
yeah.
These are changings of the of the work, which are within the range of the language. And these freedom sometimes is necessary.
Yeah. I mean, of course, you mentioned now a couple of times the word language. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we can look at music is that it is also some sort of a language. I don't want to pin it down there because it can be, I think, also some other things. But it can also be language. And then a language is also something that you have to learn. And then once you learn the words, you learn how to pronunciate them. And mm-hmm. once you learn how to pronunciate them, maybe later you can start reading some poetry instead mm-hmm. of prose. And this is also a process that I think lots of musicians are, of course, going through when learning new pieces. Once you learn the language of a certain composer, you know that when you play a piece by John Adams, you will understand that probably rhythmic accuracy is quite important.
Mm-hmm.
And when you play another piece, then maybe rhythmic accuracy is not the most important thing that you're after. So you start mm-hmm. to build this hierarchy mm-hmm. of what is important in one piece and what is important in another.
I would go further with this. I said sometimes I'm in the state that I consciously calculate with the impossibilities. Mm. So for example...
You did that in this piece also.
The most simple person, in vain. There are many parts where in the same fast movements, one has septuplets, one has eightuplets, one has ninetuplets, and so on. If you play this on the computer, it sounds horrible, because it's exactly in time.
Yeah.
But if you play in vain as it is composed, there are human beings who are not able to play this, because consciously composed it in that way, because nobody stays in this rhythm. They are always getting faster and so on.
And also the conductor is not a metronome, so he might be 60 in one measure and 61 in another measure.
Exactly.
So
in my later pieces, I write it down. I say, please don't try to be exactly in time. You are allowed to be within the range of a 32nd, 16th before and after it, but it must be a natural flow.
Yeah, the interesting thing is this happened here also. And the orchestra literally got a little bit lost in translation when they got the scores.
Mm-hmm.
And they called me and they let us know, like, sorry, we can't play this. You know, this is impossible. Mm-hmm. And then we went here together in the spring mm-hmm. and we did two rehearsals with them over a weekend, which was fabulous that the orchestra allowed us this. And we just explained it to them and they started to understand that it was actually really not that hard, but that indeed you cannot, and I can't even hear if they play 10 against 9 against 8 against 7. Mm-hmm. And also it's not important. But if you would have written something else, then it would have sounded like some irrelevant stuff.
Well, but I just bring this example to explain how amazing a wonderful conductor can be. When the orchestra got this score, that was a kind of a revolution. This cannot be performed, we destroy our instruments, it's the most difficult thing I ever have seen, and so on. And then first we had a discussion online, and this makes it a little bit down, but the real important thing happened in the rehearsals in May. And you must imagine, here are 20 string players prepared for the revolution.
I don't think 20 were prepared for the revolution.
Okay.
I think most of them were curious.
But some of them were prepared.
Yeah, a couple had their doubts.
And then Bas Wiegers came here and just calmed it down. And how you calmed it down was not that you said, okay, I'm the conductor, I'm the boss, you have to do this. What you did is, look, this sounds amazing. And the composer can have the most beautiful ideas, if there is not somebody here who is really believing in it and translating it in a language which is understandable by those who are nervous to do it or feel unsafe. And of course, I have to confess, this piece is really problematic. The string instruments have to tune their strings in a different way. Yeah. This means it's like if you are a dancer and you don't dance on a flat ground, but on, the three-dimensional sculpture of sea waves. And this is definitely a problem. But then to explain, all these movements which the dancer does in this situation creates the beauty of the dance. This is,
I think, what happens always, or I mean, what happens in a good rehearsal, is that you manage to make clear to the musicians to give them a purpose, actually, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that they know what they are doing,
yeah.
And maybe not why they're doing. I mean, that is maybe one step too far, but that they know I am doing this and it amounts to this. And if they don't know, if there's no purpose in their musician life, then it becomes something that is irrelevant and uninteresting. But once they feel like, okay, what I'm doing has a sense, and now I want to put myself behind it, then the music is charged and then it gets the right energy. And then if you play a wrong note, that is really not the end of the world. But if the energy in what you're doing is right, then that is what music is, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And excuse me, they always play wrong notes.
We always play wrong notes, of course, everybody.
Everybody. Yeah. That's,
and but also in Wagner, also, I mean, it happens everywhere. Okay. Maybe one last question, because it's getting a long, it's becoming a long podcast, but it's wonderful talk, so it's fine. But a last question, I found this came through social media to me, and I find it a nice question. Did you have happy accidents where you wrote something and a performer did something else, and that maybe you didn't mean, but that made you very happy in the end?
Well, if I would say yes, it would be too few. I one of the things I teach my students, the question, how was the penicillin invented, found? There was a culture of bacteria, and this culture of bacteria was molded. And the scientists also looked at it and said, oh wow, all the bacteria are dead in the center. I am 100% sure it was approximately the 250th time that these cultures were molded in that way. But it was the first time that the scientists did not throw it away full of rage, because it is a problem, of course, mm-hmm. It is, but just with an open, clear mind looked on it. And I cannot tell you a single example. I can tell one example. It was Opera Nacht, where a trombonist misunderstood the bar number, and there was all the orchestra played one harmonic chord, and only the trombone played something completely wrong, out of tune. They said, "Wow!" And in the next opera, Die schöne Wunde, I composed an overtone chord in the orchestra. And it's about, it's Kafka, Landarzt, also rural doctor or land doctor, I don't know the English translation, and where he suddenly is moved from one place to another and doesn't understand why it is. I have an overtone chord and I have the temperated system of the singer, and this worked wonderful, and I learned here, and this is important for my later development of my language, I learned that one of the consequences of the non-tonal, what shall I say, tonality, beauty, harmonic sound and so on, is that I don't have the necessity to fit melody and sound into the same space, which is now
definitely in this opera also very present.
Accidents like this happen very often, and I consciously teach my students, please listen to this. And I think some composers who are really focused I'm the policeman, I have to check, does everybody really do what I have noted? But when you do, you can forget it.
Yeah.
Just listen what happens and think, yeah, wow, next time I can use it.
It's interesting. It's very interesting because it's also something that for me as a conductor or even also as a violinist, the fact that you can let go at some point and don't care about all those things that you've learned, but you need to grow a little bit older to stop caring about things and let them happen.
Yeah.
And the more you feel that, the more freedom and the more breathing comes into your music, I think. Well, this is, I think, as much as we have time for.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And thank you so much for your friendship in art, which is one of the most beautiful things which exists.
Same from my side.
Thank you.
So, that was a great talk with Georg Friedrich Haas. We struggled to find the term for performance practice, and I accidentally invented the verb to pronunciate instead of to pronounce, but it was fun nevertheless. The bottom line conclusion for me would be that when you work closely with a composer, the issue of interpretation sort of dissolves when you manage to have a fine-tuned communication. Now, I'm not quite done with the subject, and I will definitely have another go at it later, from different angles. But for now, thank you for listening to The Treasure Hunt. If there are things you would like me to speak about in this podcast, contact me through my website or on Twitter. My name there is @Wiegersbas. Please follow this podcast on your favorite platform and stay tuned for the next episode.